Long before I had recorded my first episode, I had reached out to somebody to say, I need you to be on my podcast to help navigate a hormones 101 conversation. And today, I finally get to have the episode I've been dreaming about. I am speaking with someone who does this in private practice, in community health, who works with people. Women as patients, healthcare providers as students, as she helps the world understand better what's going on and what can we do about it. I do want to remind you that surfing the quicksand is for entertainment purposes and nothing that you hear today should be considered medical advice. Welcome to Surfing the Quicksand. I'm your host, Kathy Vines. When women feel well, everything changes. I read that quote on a bio for today's guest, and I have to admit that the simplicity of that statement kind of shook me because has anything been more true than when women feel well, everything changes? My guest today is Megan Price, and she's a family nurse practitioner in community health. She's a Menopause Society certified practitioner and an ASECT certified sex counselor. And she also has her own private practice outside of her community health setting, which is a concierge women's health service. That, of course, focuses on sexual health and intimacy and menopause and perimenopause, but women's health in general. I came across Megan some time ago, probably when she was first starting this practice. And as soon as I saw her, I said, "Hey, I'm launching a podcast. I would love to have you on it." And I am so excited to finally have Megan Price with me today. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you. I'm so excited too. It took me way too long to finally get on here. It's been a busy year, but I'm excited.
Well, I love that it's a busy year. That means things are going well. I wanted you, we kind of approached you around a kind of a hormones and hormone HRT, hormone replacement therapy 101, and really bringing what I think, what I can tell is such a passion for you to end misinformation, take taboo out of so many things, and really have practical, life-changing conversations with women on their bodies and their health, and having a more positive outlook on what they can be doing and what's in their control during perimenopause, menopause, and after. I want to start with talking about you as a medical practitioner first, though. So I know you came out of you're still in, you're in a kind of community health setting. You are a nurse practitioner. So walk us through first, like, what is a nurse practitioner? What do you do in that world? And then we're going to talk about kind of how you started getting into the sexual wellness space.
My entry point into being a nurse practitioner was it was interesting. At the time, after college, I was doing just like research, and I was working with kids with cystic fibrosis at Children's Hospital, and I loved it. And I was like, "Ooh, I think I like working with people more than I like working with mice." And so I looked into going to med school, and I couldn't even afford to apply to it. And I noticed that the nurse practitioners on the floor I was working on, like, just had these really wonderful relationships with their patients. They seemed to have a lot less stress in their life. And they got more time with their patients, which was really cool. And so I shadowed them for a little bit and thought, oh yeah, this is exactly kind of my speed. This is what I want. I'm very relational. So that's where I ended up as a nurse practitioner. And my heart has always been for community health. So I've spent my entire career, 13 years at this point, in community health. And I always say, like, I'll never leave it, even if my private practice becomes like super successful and amazing. I love what I've been able to build over in our community health center, and I think I'll be there forever. So.
I love that every time I've heard you speak about your practice and yourself, it's been in that kind of I am a community health person. So talk about kind of the journey of saying, I want to get into this space. I'm gonna create a practice. I'm gonna create a focus inside where I am. What was behind that? How did you make that happen?
think so. It's funny because in all of my training, I made connections with other nurse practitioners who were able to kind of start their own practices. And I always said, "Oh, that's not me. I don't have an entrepreneur spirit. You know, I like having a boss. I like having PTO." But unfortunately, I mean, the way that our healthcare system has evolved, it's extremely, extremely hard, especially in primary care, to do it full time for very long. And the way that my family is structured, I have to work full time. And, you know, we get health insurance through my job. And I just could not do it anymore. I hit burnout so hard. I was losing my compassion. I was losing kind of my joy in it. And so, you know, I was seeing like 80 patients a week. It was wild. And just feeling like I wasn't providing the kind of care that I wanted to provide. You know, I have all this great training, but you can't do it in 10 or 15 minutes every 3 to 4 months, right? And so I was just getting really frustrated, and I started to think like, well, what could this look like? What if a private practice could fill my cup in terms of like really being able to provide the care that I think women deserve, and also help bring back kind of my joy and passion for community health because I won't be as burned out, right? Like those days are still tough, but two of or three of those days a week is much better than five, right?
For sure.
And sure enough, you know, I think the last year has really proven that to be true. Like I kind of have these two, I have my foot in two worlds, and it's incredibly fulfilling.
How have you found managing having those two worlds? I know for me, people always ask me, they're like, what do you do? I'm like, oh, well, I'm a professional organizer and I'm a career coach and a resume writer and a speaker and a this and a that. And they say, oh my gosh, your days sound crazy. I'm like, I have no 2 days are the same, and especially as an entrepreneur, it's also like networking and going to the chamber events and doing the things to build a business. Even when you're not working with patients, you are still in business building mode. So, how have you found adjusting to this life?
It's tough. I mean, it's really tough. I think I've learned so much over the past year. Like I was not a businesswoman at all this time last year, and now I feel like, okay, I'm getting my feet wet. I kind of know what I'm doing now. I'm being able to say no to things, you know. Last year I was like, I gotta say yes to everything. But I think I'm realizing that I def like we're at the point now where I'm hiring another nurse practitioner, really starting to expand and be able to provide more services. I cannot wait until I can afford to hire an office manager to take care of some of the less glamorous parts of this work that definitely take up a lot of time. But you know, I again, I think when you're energized by what you're doing, when you're passionate about it, like it doesn't feel like a lot of work. Like, you know, if I like were actually to sit down and list out everything I do in a day, I think it would be insane. But it doesn't feel like that at the moment because I just love the women that I'm seeing here at Mystic Valley, and I love my patients over at my community health center and all the teaching engagements that I'm doing. It really just energizes me. So I think that makes the difference. I'm sure you experienced that too, right?
Absolutely. And you know, and I early on in my organizing career and my essentially my entrepreneurial career, I went to a conference, and it was a professional organizers conference, and I went to a session on how to be in business after year 10. And I was in year one, and I said, oh, I'm gonna go to this because I think the lessons that I'm gonna hear are probably good lessons I need to know from the beginning. And one of them was, you need to have a diversification of what you do and what you sell and what your services are, because you need to be a little bit like recession proof. You're never going to happen in the park markets, but you might get hurt. What are you going to do if you get hurt and you can't physically organize? What else are you going to do? But the number one thing, she said, you're going to get burnt out, or you're going to have clients that suck the life out of you or break your heart. And there are going to be times you're just like, I can't do this part anymore. So you better be sure you have other things in your portfolio that you love, that you're good at, and that will still make you money. And it was such a freeing lesson for me, because I do like to do lots of different things. So to know going into starting that journey, I was like, oh, this is a long game. I can love everything, but it doesn't mean I'm going to love everything all the time. And it doesn't mean it's always going to be busy and people, sending me emails and ringing my bell trying to say, "Hey, can you work with me?" So how do I kind of build things a little pedestal here and a little pedestal here so that the whole portfolio feels valuable and fulfilling and not burning me out?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great way to put it.
It would be malpractice of me not to say that part of burnout and part of things was also kind of going through perimenopause and the menopause and all of this during this time frame. It's, change your whole life, change your profession, change everything else. And by the way, your body is changing too. And so I probably started about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, with my body really just saying, "Yeah, we're done here. I don't know what you thought we were doing for 50 years, but we've stopped. We're doing very different things now." So my understanding of hormones and hormone replacement and all the kind of thing is kind of new, kind of novel, and very much like based on my own personal experience. So I want to start kind of shifting over to the education that I know you can bring us, which is like first with a like hormones 101. What is going on with perimenopause, menopause? What's going on with our bodies when it comes to our hormones that we are either noticing, not noticing, and to prepare for?
I wish the limitations of podcasts sometimes. I have this graph that I show every single woman who comes into my office that gives a really nice representation of what our hormones do over the course of our life. And every woman's experience is completely different. Science hasn't come far enough yet for us to figure out women's specific sensitivity levels to these hormones, but we know that it's there. And so it looks different for everybody, but in general, we talk mostly about estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone. So progesterone is a hormone that is responsible for regulating your mood and your sleep. And it starts to drop pretty dramatically in early perimenopause. And for a lot of women, that's late 30s, early 40s. And when that drops, we start to see sleep disruption. We see cycle irregularity. So if you are cycling, so if you have your uterus, you don't have an IUD or anything like that, your periods actually start getting closer together. So that's kind of like a big myth that I talk about with other medical providers is there's this thinking like, well, your periods aren't spacing out, so you're not in perimenopause yet. And it's actually the opposite. So when they start getting closer together, that tells me like, ooh, you're entering perimenopause. And then you also start to get mood dysregulation. So anxiety is a big one. So anxiety at night, especially. So feeling like you can't go to sleep, you get palpitations, your mind's racing. I have women who suddenly develop anxiety, like driving in tunnels or over bridges, which like we're in Boston, kind of hard to avoid.
Both.
Both of them. Or new anxieties with public speaking. Okay, I have so many women who are really like advancing in their careers, and then suddenly the things that they've kind of been proud of themselves for being really good at suddenly are develop they've developed anxiety around it. And what that does to your kind of identity, to your self-esteem, can be really, really rough. And so that's kind of the early process. And then as you shift more into later perimenopause, we see more of a shift in estrogen. Estrogen starts declining around the same time, a little bit after the progesterones in some women, but it starts to get really, really erratic in late perimenopause when our periods start spacing out. It can go up, down, and that change is really what can drive a lot of severe symptoms in women. So women with migraines have a really, really tough time in late perimenopause. This can often be what triggers hot flashes and night sweats, which I think are the popular, kind of symptoms that everyone talks about, but only I think like 40% of women have them. So it's not even, it's not universal. So again, if your provider's like, oh, you're not having hot flashes and night sweats, this definitely isn't hormonal. That's a myth. And then as you shift into true menopause, which is 12 months without a period, and then postmenopause, your ovaries are just not making those hormones anymore. And so you kind of like flatline a little bit. And then testosterone is interesting. It's not necessarily linked to menopause. It's actually more of a slow decline, just naturally with age, and some women tend to be lower than others. And this is an area where some women seem to be really sensitive to testosterone and others don't. So some women, when their testosterone gets low enough, they'll have low libido, low energy, low motivation, kind of that classic like 4 p.m. hits and I cannot do anything for the rest of the evening, right? Or I have a lot of athletes who suddenly just cannot get out of the house to do whatever kind of physical activity they like. So I had a woman who was doing marathons. Every year she would do a marathon in a different city, and she just couldn't get out of the house to run anymore. And that was such a big part of her identity for her whole life, right? And so she was feeling depressed. It's causing a lot of relationship strain because he was a runner too. We bumped up her testosterone, and that motivation came back. But on the same token, I think maybe like 30 to 40% of women, I put them on testosterone because their levels are low and nothing changes. They feel no difference at all. So it's very, very individualized, a woman's experience.
So interesting. So first of all, you like already out of the gate busted like several myths, right? The periods speed up or get closer together during perimenopause. That was definitely my experience and what got me to the doctor in the first place. I'm like, I don't, this isn't, this wasn't the what the book said I'm supposed to be doing. And I really appreciated the not 40% of people maybe have hot flashes and lots of people don't. Hot flashes were never my thing, right? So, and I don't know if that was because I was already getting some sort of treatment, because when I had those period problems, we put me on an IUD, which is like a weird thing to do at 50. But I'm like, all right, if it'll help,
Not
and it
great. I love
helped.
it.
If it'll help, and I won't name check him, but like my gynecologist is a 60-something-year-old white guy who's like, I went to see him, he's like, Kathy, let's talk about hormone therapy. Do you want to talk about it? Yes, let's talk about it, right? So I'm really lucky. I've
You
got a great
are.
medical team.
I love
I'm
that.
all in. But it was like, oh, he's like, I think an IUD will help. They check for all the things. Like, I think this will help. And so I always wondered, I'm like, did I just get like a safe harbor with the fresh IUD that protected me from other things? Maybe. But the thing, forget about what it's doing in terms of that. One of the things I heard you say a couple of times, which I loved, no, I didn't love, I hated, but I loved hearing, is how much these changes, each individual one of these hormones, impact our identity and our view of ourself and our perspective and our. Nobody's going through these saying, oh, I suddenly feel better. I suddenly love public speaking. I'm not hearing that their identity is being shaken for the better. I'm hearing that their identity is being shaken, and it's bad enough we're going through physical transformation that doesn't feel great. But knowing what that does to your psyche and your self-esteem and your self-worth and your relationships and your professional standing, that all feels shattering too.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the way I like to put it is menopause is a major neuroendocrine transition. It's affecting every single part of your body, but it is also existential. I mean, it really penetrates every single part of your life in terms of work, the family unit, how you see yourself, because everything's changing. And I don't want to make it so negative. Like, I think that this transition can, for a lot of women, is really empowering as well, because I think you just lose all of your kind of like concerns and inhibitions to a certain extent, right? Kind of like when I was preparing to give birth, I was like a little younger and was like, oh gosh, like I'm going to be naked in front of a bunch of people, like they're all going to be seeing me, which is crazy. I'm medical, but like still I just like had this thing in my head, and my mom was like, when you are giving birth, you will not care. You will rip off your clothes. You do not care who sees you. And I think that that's kind of how perimenopause and menopause can feel for some women. They're like, I don't care what people think of me at this point. This is me. I am feeling empowered in my body and who I am. I think it can take time to get there, though. And I think that the hormone changes make it really difficult for us to get to that point where we're feeling like our true selves and we are like, this is me, you know? And so my hope is that by kind of providing this care, I can help women get there quicker, right? Like things are going to be changed. I'm not going to make you 22 again. That's just not, maybe that's a bad business model, but like I'm not going to promise that. But I do think that we can like make this like a truly like wonderful transition for women, you
I mean, I don't even want to be 32 again, let alone 22, but I can
know?
hear how some people might. That's fine if that's you. I think one of the things, I'll go back to my story, like, gee, my periods were all crazy. And I wasn't thinking, oh, this is perimenopause. I was thinking, oh, I have uterine cancer and I'm gonna die, right? Like I didn't get to this is normal. I got to this is scary. And so the idea of going through a metamorphosis like you're describing, it's one thing if somebody like rings your doorbell and it's like, hi, I'm the menopause fairy. Just want to let you know, starting today, welcome, and here's your kit, right? Like that doesn't happen. At least then you'd be like, all right, this is normal. But until then, it's like, I don't know what's going on with my body. I don't recognize myself. Is it a problem with my marriage? Is it a problem with my body? Am I, failing at work? You don't know. So many times where, I've talked to so many people already on this podcast that speak about this as a time of reinvention and clarity and losing inhibition and finding their voice. But it's always like rearview mirror. Like, oh, now that I realize what I went through, now I'm feeling good. But like in the moment or in the early times, it's scary and confusing.
Absolutely. And a lot of damage can be done in that time, right? Because we don't understand where it's coming from. So we think about like 15% of women will leave the workforce because of the menopause transition. There's higher divorce rates, and like, correlation's not causation, but like it's absolutely contributing, right? When we think about everything that women are going through, women are more likely to be diagnosed with a psychiatric disorder in midlife. And we know that a lot of that is an underlying hormonal mechanism, right? So it's not that she needs a mood stabilizer. She just needs some progesterone and some estrogen a lot of the time. So yeah, it is scary. It's confusing. I think it's also so tough to be a consumer of information right now. I mean, you get on social media and you can hear five different things from five different people who all have MD at the end of their name, right? I think it's really hard to know what's good information, who can I trust? And that's why I like to be on social media and I like to go out and do a lot of like free educational talks because I like to think that I can provide a little bit of trust and clarity for people because it's so hard right now to know what to do and what to believe.
I want to talk a little bit about how I think you're right, right? My Instagram feed and anybody who's watching this podcast who also is on social media is getting exactly what you're talking about. And we're getting here, this is a great device to help with your frozen shoulder. And here you need this. And here you need this tea and all the things. So forget about the fact that we're being sold to. We get that. That's part of the social media game. But the idea of this person, this doctor has this advice, and this doctor has a different advice, and this doctor has something else is confusing. When you are, people come into your practice, let's shift a little bit to how you are as a practitioner. People come into their practice. Do you find they know nothing, know something, know bad things? Like what are you dealing with in terms of that information triage when somebody's coming to you for the first time?
Everyone's different. I have women who are completely disconnected from social media, God bless them, and they're like, I know nothing about this. I just heard that you can help me. Please help me, I do have a lot of women who are, very, very into the whole wellness scene. And I have wellness in my name. I don't say that as a derogatory, word, but and so they have a very different perspective on health than a lot of my other patients, and so that's why I love having so much time to spend with my patients because you have to know where somebody's coming from. You have to know what their values are, to really be able to be a partner with them and helping them feel better, right? And so that's why everybody's care plan with me can look so different, because I have some women who are like, listen, I do not like the idea of being on a prescription medication at all. And I need help kind of getting on board with like the fact that I'm going to be standing in CVS line picking up a prescription, because in their mind that means that they are unhealthy, right? And that's an interesting perspective that like I don't share, but that's my patient. That's their value system, you know? And so I need to like be extra sympathetic and empathic about where they're coming from and help them understand, you know, well, these hormones are like identical to what's in your body. Can we think about them almost like a supplement, right? Do we want to do a HRT club home delivery service so you're not standing in CVS, right? And that's not triggering for you. You know, and so everybody's so different. The information they're taking in is different. I never dismiss somebody's concern. I have a lot of women who are very scared of mammograms. I think right now on social media, there's a lot of misinformation about mammograms and that they cause more damage than you know, finding and saving lives. I never dismiss that in the visit. I kind of say like, hey, can we maybe talk about this a little bit more? And can I tell you my perspective? Like, and it's always a conversation, right? I think medicine has had a big ego for way too long. And I think it's very obvious to anybody practicing medicine that just telling women they're wrong and that they need to like either just do what I say or find somebody else isn't working, right? That's not helping anybody feel better.
And I do think, I've said on this podcast many times that Gen X is the first generation to have social media before, during, and after menopause, right? So we are exposed to an opportunity of learning and, in all the best ways than any other generation has had. But social media has also helped people become better consumers. Again, maybe there's misinformation, maybe there's one thing, but the idea of saying, no, just because my doctor says this, I don't have to take yes for an answer or no for an answer. I have options. And I don't think that's something that most generations alive today grew up understanding about what their relationship with a medical practitioner is. I want to talk about talking to our medical practitioners after we talk about you and what you're doing, but that's a really important conversation I want to get to. So let's put a pin in that. So somebody's coming to you and they say, help me understand what my options are with hormone therapy. Tell me what I should be scared about. Tell me what I shouldn't be scared about. What does that look like for your conversations?
I think I start with the basics of, you know, when thinking about hormone therapy, we can kind of put it into two buckets. There is the body identical, bioidentical is a very common word that's out there. That's a marketing term. And so a lot of us prescribers will say body identical to kind of separate ourselves from the marketing aspect. But they're the same. And then synthetic, which is also kind of a misnomer because everything made in the lab is technically synthetic. But the concept here is that we have a bucket of hormones that are structurally the same as the hormones that are in your body. And then we have a bucket of hormones where the chemical structure is completely different than what's in your body. Okay, and those that we'll call synthetics for simplicity's sake, those are great for contraception. That's why they were created. They prevent pregnancy. It's a completely different risk profile than the identical stuff. The identical is really it has wonderful receptor activity, right? So it's hitting the receptors in your body because that's what those receptors were created to respond to, right? Much better safety profile, very well tolerated. They don't protect against pregnancy. Okay. So you can see how, especially in perimenopause, when you can absolutely still get pregnant in perimenopause, why somebody might choose an oral contraceptive, a synthetic hormone. But if we are trying to treat perimenopause symptoms, menopause symptoms, then that identical hormone therapy is going to be the most effective thing. And there's plus and minuses for both of these, you know? So the identical stuff has so many benefits beyond just treating your symptoms. So it's going to protect your bones. Okay, it's FDA approved for prevention of osteoporosis. It's cardioprotective. We see less heart disease for women who start hormone therapy early in the menopause transition. There's so many benefits that, again, oral contraceptives aren't giving us. I'm not anti-oral contraceptives at all. Like, preventing pregnancy is absolutely a huge benefit, right? But I think what happens is that women, that's all they're being offered. They're only being offered a synthetic oral contraceptive, and there are so many reasons why that might not be the best option for women during this time.
I've already learned a lot in that. I not even I didn't know, but like I never really even thought about the fact that if you're giving somebody oral contraceptions, that it's like, oh, here, take estrogen. You're taking the pill, which is what? It is a hormone pill. It's just doing with a different job. It's got a job description, but it's not the same thing. And so, first of all, if you are in a situation where you don't want to get pregnant, don't confuse the fact that you're wearing an estrogen patch with it's not the patch or whatever. It's not birth control. So that's important. Also important is to remember you can probably get pregnant later than you thought you could under perimenopause. But this notion of the contraception, but the body identical is like, oh. Yeah, it's going to do the thing that you wanted it to do, but also we're seeing this positive, this positive, this positive, especially in areas we know impact women's health so significantly, like bone health and cardiovascular health.
Yeah, I mean, I tell women what I see in primary care, the things that are putting my older women who were previously healthy in nursing homes. Okay, so those are that's heart disease, number one killer of women in the US. That's a fragility fracture from osteoporosis. Okay, 50% of women after a hip fracture will not regain their full mobility. And a significant number will actually die within 1 year of that hip fracture. Dementia. Okay, I think the cognitive benefits of hormone therapy it's still hotly debated. It does seem that, again, the earlier you start hormone therapy in the menopause transition, the more protective it is from things like Alzheimer's and dementia. And then fourth, actually, this is a fun one. So urosepsis, okay? So UTIs in old age are very dangerous, right? So if I get a UTI now, I get burning when I urinate, I get frequency, I know I have it, oftentimes before it even shows up on a urine test. When you're older, you just don't have those symptoms. And so a lot of women will present to the emergency room with a UTI because of mental status changes. They'll become delirious, or they will have sepsis. So that UTI, that infection has moved to their blood. And that's called urosepsis. And that's a significant cause of morbidity and mortality in old age. And guess what prevents that? Local vaginal estrogen, which every single woman after the age of 50 should be on. I don't care if you have estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, you should be on that. It's incredibly safe. And so it's wild to me that primary care has slept on hormone therapy for so long, because we're in the business of prevention. And look what we just prevented the top four things that are really affecting women's lives as we age and keeping us from being functional, you know?
It is amazing. And I know we won't go into this here, and I've mentioned it in a couple other podcasts, but I'll link it in there that there was the dark ages of no of doctors saying we can't, and the black box warning on hormone therapy, which was lifted last year, that's really allowed for these conversations, I think, to be a little bit more in the open. But for many years, doctors were prevented from prescribing. They were discouraged. They certainly didn't buy into the value. So to have such a positive switch of like, wait a minute, first of all, is great, and also it's great in all these other ways. It feels like a very new time in medicine. I do want to share a ridiculous conversation with my gynecologist, who I mentioned. So we knew going to the conversation that we were probably going to talk about hormone replacement therapy, and does to the internal exam, and like he like comes on back. He's like, okay, we're gonna get you on vaginal estrogen. Like I didn't ask about it. He just don't. I was just like, oh, he just on his own recognized I had like a real fixer-upper situation and was like, "You, we're gonna get you some of that." So to hear,
I have to get this man's name from you after this
I
because,
will,
like,
I
I
will.
this is like warming my heart.
I will.
I love this.
Listen, I love my primary care physician. I love my guardian. I am really lucky when it came to doctors, and I know that, and I embrace that. But you know, for him, for he, then to hear you say, "Listen, every woman over 50 should be using vaginal estrogen." So, like, let's talk about that for a second. What is it? Why should we be using it? Let's talk about it.
Sure. So, when thinking about estrogen, we can also kind of lump it into two categories as local and systemic. So, systemic means like it is a high enough dose that it is affecting all the parts of your body. A local is a low dose, and so it's pretty much just staying where we put it for the most part. So local vaginal estrogen is estrogen. Typically, it's a cream. It can also be a tablet, can be a ring. That we put on the vulvovaginal tissues to help improve blood flow, to help keep those tissues nice and perfused with blood, so blood flow, and then also lubricated. So it used to be called atrophic vaginitis or vaginal atrophy. Now we call it genitourinary syndrome of menopause because it's not just the tissue we can see that's affected by estrogen decline. It's the urethra, the bladder. We call it the bladder trigone. So it's this whole area in our genital area that's affected by this estrogen decline. And that leaves us more susceptible to UTIs, to vaginal infections, to pain with sex. I have a lot of women who haven't been able to tolerate penetration for years post-menopause. And within months of using vaginal estrogen, they're able to again. I mean, that's how powerful this stuff is. And so I tell women, it's not even if you're not sexually active, I still want you on it because we want to prevent UTIs again. And so it's very, very safe because it's low dosed. There's not meaningful systemic absorption. And so again, literally almost nearly every single woman on the planet can use it. And I really kind of push providers to use it preventatively. So we don't have to wait for the tissues to break down. We know that every woman who goes through menopause is going to develop genitourinary syndrome of menopause if they're not on enough estrogen. So let's just give it to them, right? It's twice a week. How easy is that? You know, it's just twice a week rubbing a cream into your tissues and you're done. So I think it's such an easy intervention. One more thing, I know I'm talking a lot, but this one I'm really passionate about. So, pap smears. So, you are more likely to have what's called an unsatisfactory pap smear post-menopause because you don't get enough cells on the swab when you do a pap smear. So, it comes back and they say, oh, it's an unsatisfactory sample. We have to do it again. And if you get two in a row, two unsatisfactories in a row, you have to get a colposcopy, which is,
I've had
yes,
one. No,
okay.
thank you. No, thank
And
you.
guess what helps prevent unsatisfactory pap smear results? Local vaginal estrogen. Okay, so that's like one of my big soapboxes at the clinic. I say, listen, if you get an unsatisfactory result in a postmenopausal woman, put her on vaginal estrogen for at least 3 months. I mean, ideally, she's using it for the rest of her life, but at least 3 months before you repeat that pap smear. Save her from a procedure that she does not need, right? Probably
Wow.
does not need. So again, there's just so like it's just a little cream that you can pick up at CVS. It is a miracle worker. It's incredible what it does.
Oh my gosh. I want to go backwards to systemic, right? Because you made the really the good distinction between that's not what this is. So let's talk about systemic. What is that?
So systemic could be usually we think about it as either oral or transdermal through the skin. So oral tablet that you swallow, and then through the skin can be a patch, a gel, a spray. There is a systemic vaginal ring. It's not covered by insurance very often. I don't have a lot of women who like to use it, but that can be really helpful for some women who. So I have a few patients with really severe rheumatoid arthritis to the point where they don't have a lot of dexterity in their hands. And so, you know, I just insert a vaginal estrogen ring. It lasts them several months and then they come back and I switch it out for them too. So we always think about like ability too, right? So that's why looking at the person in front of you is really important. And then so even orally versus through the skin, those are very different risk profiles. So taking it orally, it gets a bad rap, but I love it. I love oral. It lowers your cholesterol. It's very easy to take. But a lot of women aren't even offered it because of this increased risk of blood clot. And I always like to put that into context because just being a woman in the world, your risk of a blood clot is 2 in 1,000. And taking an oral contraceptive increases your risk to 4 in 1,000. We're not telling a lot of women, oh my gosh, do not take an oral contraceptive, right? Because of that increased risk. And then pregnancy, nature's greatest stress test, increases your risk to 10 in 1,000. All right. Oral estradiol increases your risk from 2 in 1,000 to 3 in 1,000. So it's less than an oral contraceptive, and it's significantly less than pregnancy. So if I tell providers all the time, if you would not hesitate to put the woman in front of you on an oral contraceptive, you should not hesitate to do oral estradiol. And also, if the woman in front of me has gone through 3 pregnancies, she's done great. She hasn't had any blood clots. She's not a smoker. There's no other things increasing her risk. I'm like, why not? If you want to do a pill because it's easy, let's do it. But most women do opt for a patch. Just I think it's easy. You know, you put it on and you forget about it. There's a weekly and then a twice weekly. And when you take it through this, when you take estradiol through the skin, there's no increased risk of blood clot at all. So that's why a lot of women who maybe have a lot of comorbidities, diabetes, high blood pressure, even certain clotting disorders, we can put them safely on a patch.
But no positive impact to cholesterol if you're doing the patch.
Not as much. No, it
Okay.
doesn't seem. Again, I think we are always wanting more research in women's health, but we don't see that as much. No.
Yeah. Okay. I'd never heard about the cholesterol as a th again, you're curing all the things. I love it.
I know.
And then I believe this is true, so you'll fact check to me. If you go on estradiol in whatever form and you still have your uterus, even if you're in menopause, you need progesterone. Is that
Absolutely.
correct?
Yep.
Okay. All right.
That's correct. So progesterone is kind of my go-to in perimenopause too, as a first step, because man, you take that 20 to 30 minutes before bed and it just really helps with sleep, really helps calm down anxiety. It's so nice. I always thought I was a good sleeper, and then I started progesterone and I was like, oh, this is what good sleep is. So progesterone is helpful in a lot of ways. You can take it by itself, but you're right. If you have a uterus, if we give you estrogen, we also have to give you progesterone. And that's because estrogen builds up the lining of the uterus. And progesterone kind of helps keep it in check. So if we found this out, not we, I wasn't around, but when they first started doing hormone therapy in like the 60s, 70s, they discovered pretty quickly that just giving women estrogen, even though they felt a lot better, they were causing a lot of endometrial hyperplasia because that it would just thicken and thicken and thicken, and that's a precursor to uterine cancer. So progesterone just kind of helps keep everything in check, and the uterus loves progesterone. It would bathe in it if it could. So taking both together is necessary. And then if you don't have a uterus, if you've had a hysterectomy, you can still take progesterone. I have a lot of women who opt to take it because, you know, they feel great on estrogen, but they're still having difficulty falling asleep. And so we add it and they love it.
That's great. Thank you so much. And I know we already talked a little bit about how you've used testosterone in times too. I wanna get back to the conversation, put a pin in about having a conversation with your medical team, with your medical practitioner. I've obviously already raved about mine. This is not a personal issue, but at the same time, I know how unique this is. And I was kind of reminded, getting back to, the social media of all, and I saw something on Threads the other day where somebody's like, I talked to my doctor and said, I wanted him to test, I think I'm in perimenopause. I wanted him to test my hormones, whatever. And he said, you can't be in perimenopause because you don't have any coarse facial hair. And I remember thinking, like how frustrating that must be for that patient to hear it. But like, how many other patients this doctor is just like not thinking of in terms of where are they in life? Because they have in their mind, this is what menopause looks like. This is not what menopause looks like, and it's that structure. So let's talk about how you recommend people, number one, kind of approach their primary care physician or whoever their first step is, their first stop is in medical. And then number two, what to do if you're not getting the answer you want, expected, hoped for?
I love these questions. So I actually I just put together like a whole patient guide on like advocating for yourself in these visits with like specific language to use, kind of red flags and green flags to look out for, where to go if you want to find like a very specific menopause certified provider. And so that's free. That's like available on my website, the Midlife Library, which is like a patient education portal.
We'll put that in the show notes for sure.
But just to kind of think through it. So in perimenopause, it is extremely, because remember, you're probably only getting like 15 minutes with your provider, right? And so in perimenopause, it's very important to do your best to track your symptoms. If your symptoms are worse in what we call the luteal phase of your cycle, so the last 2 weeks of your cycle, 2 weeks before your period, that is a very strong indicator that your symptoms are probably hormone mediated. You can still have symptoms every single day. And again, this is only a small subset of women, because a lot of women are on like an IUD or a hormonal contraceptive, right? But doing your best to kind of track your symptoms, and then I also have that in the guide, and being able to hand that to your provider is very helpful, because you just did a lot of work for them already, and you have kind of shown them that you are, quote unquote, a good historian. Okay. So we're helping the provider, right? We kind of have to hold their hands here and do a little bit of the work for them, because again, remember, they're under a lot of pressure. They have 10 to 15 minutes to help you. So that's great in perimenopause. Writing down kind of your like top three concerns, I think, is helpful too. So I always ask my patients, like, if I could wave a magic wand and take away three things tomorrow, what are they? And for a lot of women, that's like sleep, libido, brain fog, as I search my brain.
Ironic.
And then when you are talking to your provider, the best thing to do is focus on how this is impacting your ability to get through your day. Okay, so we call that our ADLs, our activities of daily living, right? So how is this impacting you at work? How is this impacting your relationship with your loved ones? Okay, friends, family, spouses, kids. What is it difficult for you? Because again, that language, that perks them up, right? I unfortunately, we are having to work within an incredibly misogynistic system, right? And there is this I don't know the right term to use, almost like a prejudice that happens to like a quote unquote whiny woman. So they used to call it WW in charting, to this woman in midlife who's coming in with a thousand different complaints, and like she doesn't, they're just, she's on social media too much. This is an Instagram diagnosis. I hate that, and I wish I could wave my magic wand and take that away, right? But unfortunately, that's the system we're working with. So we kind of have to figure out, we're women, we know how to work within unfair systems. Like, we have to figure out how to work within this. And so using that language of how this is impacting your daily activities, your ability to get through your work responsibilities, is really, really important. And then I gently kind of challenging some of the myths that they might perpetuate. So you might hear, well, we checked your hormones and they're normal. Okay. Perimenopause cannot be diagnosed through lab work. Okay. I'll tell women all the time, like, I'm happy to order this hormone panel. It might help us rule out like a major pituitary issue, but it when those labs come back normal, I don't want you to feel like invalidated. It does not mean that your symptoms are not hormonal, and it does not mean that we cannot safely give you hormone therapy to help you feel better. So when a provider says that to you, you can kind of gently push back and say, "Oh, I'm so glad they're normal. My understanding is that perimenopause is a clinical diagnosis. So given my symptoms, given this chart I just gave you, like, what are your thoughts on whether or not I could still be in perimenopause even with normal results?" And if they're still like, "No, labs are normal," okay, red flag, we have to go elsewhere. Like it's honestly not worth your time and like you feeling dismissed and demoralized to continue that conversation. I always tell women, like, you have the right to get up and leave an appointment anytime if a provider is like dismissing you. And then some of the other things, if they're pushing, if they are only offering you an oral contraceptive or an antidepressant, I think being able to gently say, like, okay, yeah, maybe that would help a little bit. Could we talk maybe about, these other options? So especially with an antidepressant, you can say, well, if my anxiety is potentially related to a hormone issue, would giving me some hormones maybe be a better way to treat this? Right? Like using just almost asking a question, which again, I wish we didn't have to do, right? But feeding is still working under their ego and just kind of pushing them a little bit to maybe reach for their curiosity that they lost a long time ago because of burnout, right? And then again, if somebody's like, no, this is what I have to offer you, red flag, like we can go find a menopause informed specialist.
First of all, I feel like you just handed over the secret decoder ring on so many levels. Like, track your symptoms, prioritize and rank them so you're really clear on what conversation you want to have. Identify and articulate your activities of daily living that you're struggling with, like that out of the gate, and then to also kind of go into like how to receive information and gently push back or reframe, or especially with questions and curiosity, as opposed to, a direct confrontation, which probably never ends up positive. And then ultimately, how to kind of evaluate with, are you getting red flag after red flag after red flag? Is this the right practitioner for you? Maybe it is time to go. I love this roadmap you just gave us. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I think teaching women and especially other populations that really struggle with this too. So women of color, our LGBTQ community, so many of them don't even get regular medical care because of the just constant kind of prejudice that they face in an exam room. And so I'm very passionate about not just educating medical providers, but also providing real kind of, real kind of actionable items for patients, how to advocate for yourself in an exam room.
Well, you fully take community health to heart, right? In helping all aspects of the community, those of us walking in and those in the white coats on the other side. And I'm so grateful that I know you and that I follow you on social media, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And that you have really decided to spring out on your own and embrace the "I'm not an entrepreneur, but I'm going to try this anyway" spirit to be able to bring something you love doing that clearly changes lives on terms that work for you.
Thanks. Yeah, it's fun. I feel very, very lucky that I get to do this. And I say all the time, because probably every 2 weeks I think about, like, well, I should probably just shut down my practice. This isn't going well. Like, I'm still not paying myself yet. But I just believe in it so strongly that, like, I'm always able to dig myself out of that, like, kind of negative spiral a little bit to be like, no, this is good. We're helping women. It will start paying off soon,
I've
I
been
feel
there.
lucky.
I've been there. I feel that, and keep on keeping on, I promise. I want to switch to the quicksand three, which are the three questions I ask all of my guests. So, let's start with the first one, which is when you're procrastinating or avoiding something, what's a tip or technique that you'll use to actually do it?
I bribe myself like I do my toddler. I just say, okay, you can answer these three emails and then you can go have a little treat. And so I literally have like my little box of treats next to my kids' box of treats. That's like the fancy chocolates. And yeah, if I do it, I go get one.
I love it. We are such a basic, just a basic animal. I love it.
All I need.
Okay, number two, if money and skills and time and history and geography were not an issue and not a factor. What's a career or job you might have liked to have tried?
A food critic. Hands down, I dream of just being paid to eat food. I'm a big foodie. I'm a big cook. I love cooking. I watch Top Chef. I think I've seen every session, like, or every season 5 times. I love it. That
That's
would
so
be my
cool.
dream. Yeah.
That's
I don't know
so
if I'd
great.
be good at it. I don't necessarily have a great palate, but I would enjoy it tremendously.
I don't know if I'd stay employed, but I'd certainly start being employed. Good. And then the third question is, what's a way that you recharge or hit the reset button when life gets chaotic?
I am a big gardener, and like full year. Like I know I realize we live in Massachusetts and we just had 2 feet of snow on the ground for like multiple months, but like I started seeds in my basement like end of January. When it's dead winter, I have a whole garden journal where I'm like planning different projects, like planning out the next year. That is like my happy place. I spend every morning, I get my coffee, I go downstairs and I like check in on my seeds. I talk to them. I'm a little like psychotic about it, but that really recharges me. Like being in nature, helping things grow. Like I love that because it's like a whole year process. You know, I think gardening's like the best hobby you can have.
Oh my gosh, I love that. What's your favorite thing to grow?
Right now it's dahlias. So I'm trying to actually like create. The nice thing about dahlias is like unless you're growing from the bulb, you don't know what it's going to look like. So a dahlia seed could look like anything. It's not going to look like what it came from necessarily, and you can kind of very easily kind of create your own dahlias. And so my life goal is to make 2 very distinct ones and name them after my kids. And then the cool thing about them is like you can pass them on. So, you know, the tubers multiply and you can give those out to people. And so like my kids someday can give their dahlias to their kids. Who knows if that's going to happen? But in my head, it's like, oh, I'm creating this flower legacy for my family.
That is so cool. And this is not the first time I've had a deep discussion about dahlias in answering
Really?
this question. Yes. On the podcast. So that is I'm always amazed by Massachusetts people who can grow dahlias, right? Because I feel like it seems
It's a lot
really
of work.
hard. It's really
I dig
hard. You
them
got
up.
to winter them well and all that. Like it's a lot. And I often hear stories of heartbreak of like, oh, they didn't make it. They right, you know. So good for you. And I had no idea you could create your own. That's so
It's fun.
inspirational. So cool. Megan, thank you so much for being here. I want you to tell people how they can find out more about you, if they live in Massachusetts, because I know you're only licensed in Massachusetts, if they want to kind of seek you out for a medical practitioner, if they want that guide that you talked about that you built on advocacy, tell us where we can find you.
So, I do still have a very small panel of patients as a PCP at Neighbor Health in East Boston, and I run the sexual wellness and, you know, now we've involved menopause care into that department. And I do accept all forms of insurance there. So, for patients who want to see me but need to have insurance, be a component of their care, I can see them there, but they have to have their PCP registered within our organization. And I have had some people who they're like, I don't like my PCP, that's fine. And so they come see me there. At Mystic Valley Sexual Wellness, we are cash-based. I could talk a lot about why, but unfortunately, that's where we're at right now. My hope is that in the future, we will be able to accept insurance. It's mysticvalleysexualwellness.com. You can read more about coming to see us and what our model looks like. I'm on social media a lot. I try to do a lot of education, a lot of Q&As. That's Megan Price NP for nurse practitioner, and then also Mystic Valley Sexual Wellness. And if you go to our website at the very top, it says the Midlife Library. And that's the educational portal that I'm working on for patients right now. There's some free guides on perimenopause and menopause. I'm going to also post some webinars on there so that I'm able to show a lot of the visuals that I use for patients. There's very specific guides for like things like MCAS, endometriosis, and then also soon I'm going to post these guides on how to advocate for yourself in the visit. So.
Fantastic. Oh my gosh. I will put all of those in the show notes. So for those of you who are listening while you're driving, don't rush to pull over. You'll get them over there. This has really been, it's exactly what it's better than I imagined when I approached you and asked you to be on this. I learned a ton, and I really feel like it also put some things in perspective where I'm like, wow, I at mid 50s, gosh, if I'd known some of this 10 years ago, what might have been different? And I know there are so many people who are in that space now who have learned a lot that they only know about the cautionary tales to come, but you've already turned them on to things they should be thinking about today. So I'm so grateful for your time and your generosity of your intelligence and education and development, which seems unbounded.
Thank you so much. This was really fun. I told you coming into this, I was like, I feel great. Like I just love having conversations with people about this. It's much less stressful than like teaching a full course to a room full of people. So this was wonderful. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, did I just learn so much? And hopefully you did too. Even if you are already currently practicing with hormone replacement therapy and going through things, I hope you learn some things about what you're doing and why you're doing it, or what else is available, or other conversations to have with your medical practitioner. But boy, I think everything from the conversation about how so many of these changes just really rock our identity, to how do we have a playbook to having the right conversations with our doctors around what we need or what we want or what we're experiencing. Every moment in this podcast, I learned things. And I am so grateful for Megan to be a part of the Surfing the Quicksand story. I hope you got a ton of value out of this. And all that stuff in the show notes that we're going to put about how you can follow her, even if you're not in Massachusetts and can't be her patient, I promise you, you're going to get good content just from having Megan Price in your world. Thanks so much for being here.